Oz Guinness was speaking at Mission's Fest, and he was talking about globalization, how it affects the poor. And one thing that he said, to start off, that for those especially in the fairly well-to-do West, is the temptation not to think and reflect. That we're going so fast. I was just talking with Scott. Is he in here? Yeah, we were meeting in the men's washroom there and asked how you doing. All, I'm kind of tired. He said, I'm kind of tired too. I said, why is it we're just going so fast all the time? And that's a cultural malaise for us, that we just go so fast that we don't often stop to think and reflect. And that's why I wanted to take this for a moment here, just to stop and think and reflect on Jesus, on his death. You know, he cared enough about this that he died. He was willing to allow himself to be killed. And stop and think, man, we have it so good. There's compared to, you know, what we see up there, you realize that those of us here who are in the most dire circumstances, we still have it so much better than the rest of the world. And we can do a number of things. One of them is just to feel guilty about it, not do anything about it. Another to say, it's so big I can't do anything. And this is the temptation again, you know, it's so overwhelming, is to not to think and reflect about it and ask, what can we do? And what I want to look at this morning is talk a little bit about a paradigm shift that helps us to begin to find a place to start thinking and reflect about it. I want to look first at some words of Jesus. This is taken from Matthew. Got it here in my notes. Matthew 26, verse 10 to 13. While Jesus was in Bethany at the home of a man known as Simon the leper, a woman came in to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which he poured on his head as he was reclining at the table. When his disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste, they asked. And another one of the other gospels was actually Judas that said that. Interesting enough, remember Judas... apparently he looked after the purse and he liked to help himself to it. So as Judas says, this perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor. And in another book it says that Judas really wasn't concerned about the poor. He was more concerned about the waste of this perfume. Aware of this, Jesus said to them, why are you bothering this woman? She's done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. I tell you the truth, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will be told, also be told in memory of her. And that line there, the poor you will always have with you. I want to look at that just for a moment there. Why did Jesus say that? What was he saying? And I've heard different theories. Some people say, well, you know, we need... there's only so much we can do for the poor. That, you know, the Bible says will always be with us, so it's sort of a lost cause, right? You know, we're just not going to be able to really take care of the poor, so keep them on sustenance, you know, because anything you do is like pouring good money after bad into it. You know, if God himself says poor you always have with you, then what's the point of thinking we can actually make them not poor? And believe it or not, a lot of the West, we might not say it that crassly, but perhaps we believe it to some degree, and we see these words of Jesus. And what was he getting at there? It sounds like, you know, it was more important that we honored him, so maybe we should give more money to the church to build a nice building and pay your pastors and so on and so forth than look after the poor, because the poor are always going to be poor anyways, no matter what you do, right? Lost cause. Well, first of all, who was Jesus saying this to? He was saying it to Judas. And I only found this out last week. You know, you got to be careful when you're reading the New Testament, and this is where community is so important. You know, our individualism says the Bible's all I need. I can just read the Bible. I don't need anybody else, and I'll get everything I need from the Bible. Here's a case where we need somebody who really knows the Bible and who particularly knows the Old Testament and understands the Jewish culture of the first century. And this is part of my job. I'm just a small bit in this puzzle, but this is why I speak to you, this is why I have an obligation to study and bring this to you. There's more going on here than meets at first glance, because the poor you will always have with you, to those sitting in the room that day would have gone, twig, that's a quote. That's a quote from something. And then the whole context of where that quote is from would play into the mind and would play into the situation. So he's talking to Judas, who's saying, why wasn't this money given to the poor? And knowing that Judas had no interest in the poor. And I'm sure I haven't begun to delve all this into, but does anybody know what passage that is a quote from? What passage was Jesus referring to? Okay, the next time, have any of you ever heard people talk about this, the pool you always have with you, salati-da? Have you, any of you ever heard that? Run into that? I've been hung around the church long enough. Some of you have. At any rate, if anybody ever tells you the poor you always have with you, so big deal. Here's where that quote is from. If there's a poor man among your brothers in any of the towns of the land the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted towards your poor brother. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend him whatever he needs. Be careful not to harbor this wicked thought. The seventh year, the year for canceling debts, is near, so that you do not show ill towards your needy. So you do not show ill will towards your needy brother and give him nothing. He may then appeal to the Lord against you, and you will be found guilty of sin. Sin. Give generously to him and do without a grudging heart. Then because of this, the Lord will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed toward your brothers and toward the poor and needy in your land. So what he's saying is you're never going to have an opportunity not to be generous because there will always be poor amongst you. Interesting take on that, eh? What he's saying there, there will always be poor amongst you, so don't ever think you get to a point where you won't have to be generous. That's almost scary. So we live in a world today that we're in that top, what percent was it? Top 30% of having a bank account and top, what was it, 25% that have a house and a closet with clothes in it and a bed to sleep in. We're in that top 20%. With globalization, understanding the situation of the rich and the poor becomes a little more complicated than what it had been in past times. The traditional understanding of the rich and the poor was the rich are getting richer. Okay? How many of you all heard that, right? The rich are getting richer. And that causes what? The poor to get poorer. Now, let's say in the 18th century, a slave owner, South America, that was pretty straightforward equation. You could see the guy beating his slaves, paying them less to get, so he would have more money left over, so he would have more capital for himself. If they didn't work hard enough, he'd go get a whip and whip them, and the harder he made them work, the more money he would have made. So the poorer they got, the richer he got. So, you know, on the backs of the poor, he was making his money, cut and dried. And so, you know, justice was to go in there and get him to pay his slaves more so that he wouldn't make as much. But a fairly straightforward equation, not uncomplicated, but fairly straightforward, right? Now, in our world today, that's breaking down. Excuse my squiggles, but it's the best I could do. Okay? And in a global economy, we don't see specifically us. How many of you are absolutely know that us being, we're rich on the backs of the poor? Like, okay, we are, everybody in this room is rich on world standards. So how many of us are solidly, you know, in the bottom of your heart that you're getting rich on the backs of the poor? How many of you know that? You don't know that. None of us, we couldn't live with ourselves if we knew that. We kind of know it. It's the back of our heads. So why is this breaking down? Here's a new term, systemic injustice. What is systemic injustice? Basically, where systems, world systems are in place that are unjust, and those unjust systems cause... What did I do? All right. Cause the rich to get richer and cause the poor to get poorer. And so there's a breakdown in the direct correlation between the rich getting richer causing the poor to get poorer. And this is what I want to talk about. What is systemic injustice? And try to get our heads wrapped around it just a little bit. And then start to say, okay, how do we begin as believers before God, we're called to proclaim the kingdom of God here on earth, which is freedom for the prisoners, justice for the oppressed. How do we begin? I'll give you an example of, I don't know, this is just in my own business experience, something I see. The value here in Canada for a particular nail gun is $59. They sell like hotcakes for $59. Okay? Now, this nail gun costs us FOB China. I'm using this because it's an extreme example, so it works. Costs us from China, from the port in China, $13. Okay? Costs us about $2 to get it over here. So as rich Canadians, I wish everything had this kind of market. Well, maybe, anyway, not everything is this kind of market, but this, I'm using this because it is a good example. So this thing lands us in about $15. We can sell it for $60. So we make $45 on a $15 investment. So we're making pretty good money on that. We're buying from an agent. He's only too happy to sell it to us. And am I oppressing the poor in doing that? Is there any concept that I could be oppressing the poor? Because I don't know what it costs to make that nail gun. Now, the agent, he signs us for $13. Now, he's paying, I'm going to guess based on what I know, he's probably paying about $11.50, $12 for that thing. So he's making $1, $1.50 per tool. He sells them to us 500 at a time. So he makes $600, $700 per order. He has no idea in the world what I'm selling it for. And he's making a reasonable living off of it, but he's not making a big margin on it. He's making that's the market for an agent there to sell to North America. That's what North America is willing to pay for it. So he's making about $1, $1.50, you know, maybe probably about 10%, and he does this regularly. He makes a reasonable coin. And so then you've got the people who are manufacturing this thing. Now, I'll be honest with you, I have no idea in the world how much it costs to manufacture this thing. I know looking at it, for $11, there's a lot of tool there. There's a lot of machining's gone into it. And I just don't know the condition. I've been in Taiwan about 12 years ago, 16 years ago now. And I remember going to the factories there, and they really did work hard. But I know in Taiwan at the time, an average wage was about $7 an hour. And that was in the early 90s. And for $7 an hour, everybody could rent a two-bedroom apartment and put food on the table. You eat a lot of rice. You wouldn't get rich, but you weren't on the streets either, okay? $7 an hour. Yeah. Okay? That's Taiwan, 1972. The company, the managers in that had cars. People weren't in rags. But, of course, the cost of living was way lower there because you could rent $7 an hour is $1,300 a month, and a two-bedroom apartment at that time was about $500 a month. So you know, about 40% of your income, you weren't getting rich, but you're doing okay. So what I'm saying is, for these nail guns, This is where it begins to break down. I don't know the status of the person that's making that nail gun. They might be making a reasonable hour wage. They might be 13-year-old slaves working 16 hours a day. I don't know. So what do we do? Well, we could go back to the agent and say, you know, the value of this is such, I think we're going to pay you $25 for this tool. Now, the agent, of course, is going to go, great. Now I'm making... I'm doubling my, instead of making 10%, I'm going to get rich. These guys are idiots, you know. So now all of a sudden my income from a shipment, you know, $1.50 has $750 goes up to $7,500 per gun. And you see where it begins to break down, because here I'm getting rich off the poor in a sense, but there's no way for me to change that. Like I can't go to the agent and say, I'm going to give you more, because he's going to keep it in the middle. And he doesn't know how much I'm making. So I never meet the person who's making it. He doesn't know how much I'm making it. And the whole thing about what's equitable in this breaks down. And there's a sort of a crass example of systemic injustice. It's not an easy, I can just pay them more and make less. It's just not that straight up and that straightforward. So here's where, you know, it becomes so overwhelming. The temptation is to not think and reflect, to not ask, what can I do? Because it is somewhat staggering. And I was sharing this illustration with one of the managers at work the other day, who's a believer. And he says, so what are you, a communist? And I said, well here's the problem. And this is a book I'm reading right now by Brian McLaren. And I can't remember who he's quoting, but he's talking about communism versus capitalism. Communism masters in the distribution of goods. Everything's distributed equally. But it completely fails in the production of goods. So what communism does, it makes it equally distributes poverty. Capitalism masters in the production of goods, but totally fails in the distribution of goods. So you end up with almost all the goods in the hands of a very small number. And so we need to start looking and asking, the political spectrum is sort of divided into left and right, capitalism versus communism or socialism. And both break down in practice, and some of it's because of the evil human nature. Both break down. We need more alternatives. The alternative of capitalism doesn't work. The alternative of communism doesn't work. So where do we begin? I want to give you some examples, people who've reflected and come up with brilliant ideas that have made small packets of difference, some bigger than some smaller. Distance ones, an organization called Opportunity International started about 20 years ago. There are some names associated with it you'd recognize. I don't remember what they were. Started the whole concept of microfinancing, where they would go into third world countries, and something like 82% of their clients are women. And they would give them small loans to start small business. I mean, literally, for a life-saving loan to these people at a very low interest rate would be $100 to $500, enough to buy a sewing machine. Very small loans where people could become self-sufficient. And then the repayment rate on these loans is something like 95%. It's not good money thrown after bad. It's not going, just money being given away to corrupt. They have to qualify for it. But thousands and thousands of these loans are given out there. This isn't just giving somebody food. You know, the easy one is just give them something to eat because they're hungry. It's beyond that. It's giving them a way to earn their own food and some self-worth. How many of you read the article in the local newspaper this week about the final fallout of the Tri-City churches putting up the homeless? Wasn't that amazing? I'll tell you what happened. They had an average of, 30 people a night over those... In the course of that time, 19 of those people that came in there, at the end of that session, were no longer homeless. They were either in drug treatment programs, or they'd found work, or they got social housing. 19 out of... Now, I don't know how many there were total that floated through. There's average 30 a night, so it'd be more than that that came in and out. And the bottom line was that for these people... They were desperate people, just desperate for survival, trying to stay warm, trying to get food. When this program started up, they'd come in at 11 o'clock at night, they'd be given a warm meal, a safe, warm bed, breakfast in the morning, and a bag lunch. And what changed for those 19 people was now that they weren't fighting for bare survival, they were able to start thinking. And several of them realized, I got to get off drugs. Some had time to start pursuing social housing. Some had time to start thinking about getting work. And a federal government agent looked at that, those numbers, and they were staggered. They anticipated 2 to 3. They could not believe the success of this program, that 19 people were off the streets as a result of it. It's utterly amazing. I think I've shared with you before, but a trial was done in Zurich and else across Switzerland where they decriminalized heroin. So the actual addicts were able to get a prescription from their doctor for heroin. First result, the crimes went, the black market dried up. All of a sudden, all these hundreds of addicts weren't out stealing to support their habits. So right away, the crime level went way down. They also took these addicts and found them housing. I don't know how they did, but they got them into basic social housing of some sort. Within 6 months, I can't remember what percentage it was, something like 60% were voluntarily entering treatment programs. There's an outside-the-box solution. Who would have thought that the decriminal... I'm not making any pearls, we should do this or do that, but it's an outside-the-box. By decriminalizing it, began to get these people... It didn't create more addicts. It got the current ones coming off. And, of course, once the money's gone out of it for the black market, they're not trying to get all these young people hooked on anymore because there's no future money in it. You know, the pushers standing outside the schools, why are they trying to get the kids hooked on drugs? Because once they're hooked, they got to keep coming back to them, right? And if all of a sudden those who are hooked don't have to pay the pushers prices for it, then the pushers aren't pushing to get more people on because there's nothing left in it for them. Outside the box, I mean, there is a systemic injustice. The way the system is set up, the way our system is set up right now is that illicit drugs are incredibly profitable, just hugely profitable. Okay, and the current war on drugs that we have drives the prices up and makes it even more profitable, which feeds the injustice. And of course, we have the situation here where because of the huge war on drugs money coming out of the U.S. right now, if we were to consider it would create a big problem with our neighbor to the south. So in a little way, we're trapped. But this is what systemic injustice is. It's you're trapped in a system that's a suicide system. Okay, and I'm not proposing a solution to this. I'm just painting one solution that's been done. I had a lunch with Gordy on Wednesday, and he was talking about how in Vancouver, the four pillars with harm reduction, the focus is harm reduction. There's been talk about it's not legalizing drugs, but decriminalizing them. But what they've been doing with harm reduction, the effects it's had, already there's been a significant decrease in crime with the four pillars. Does anybody know the four pillars? I don't know them off the top. Anyway, there's a lot. They're quite controversial, and interestingly enough, the more right the church, like right wing the churches are, including Stephen Harper, they're very opposed to the four pillars. But the result of harm reduction has been a lowering in crime and a lowering in death rate. There's been some very positive things that have come out of that. And Gordy's church had a meeting with their local MLA last night about that, and he's been talking with the guy who's in charge of the four pillars. And Gordy personally has met this guy, talked to him, and he says, you know, the evangelical church, on the whole, has some flawed belief systems that has tended to discourage something like the four pillars. One of our beliefs that we were all raised with comes from some of the books we've read, The Cross, the Switchblade, and others, that until a person is absolutely desperate and at the bottom, that he's not going to change. And the fact of the matter is, that really only applies to about 10% of the people that are out there, that when they get to the bottom, that they're going to make that dramatic change, they're going to get into treatment, they're going to get into a teen challenge, whatever, and they're going to get themselves on drugs when they hit that bottom. About 80% of the people, the desperation leads to more drugs, suicide, prostitution, and it becomes a spiral down of which there's no way out. And he says, for the church, we've been raised that there's no sense even trying to help somebody until they've hit rock bottom. And because of these dramatic stories of the 10% that has worked for, we assume it works for everybody, and it just doesn't. So there's a flawed belief. There's a systemic injustice that we believe that there's going to be no change until somebody hits rock bottom, that we really don't need to intervene until they come to the end of the rope. And even AA supports that as well. And again, in many people's lives, that is the case. But they're beginning to find that that's not always the case. It's not that you have to intervene before people hit rock bottom. So what's the solution? There is no one easy solution. But one thing to get past, again, like I said, is the understanding that the rich get richer, cause the poor to get poorer, and that leaves us in a place, because there's no direct or very little direct correlation there right now for us, it can often leave us stuck in a place where we don't do anything because it's just so overwhelming. And that's the general response. It's so overwhelming, what do I do? Which takes us back to the first thing. I'm not going to throw out solutions this morning. I want us to begin thinking differently about this. But the temptation to not to think and reflect, that we start thinking, we start reflecting, start rolling ideas around on our heads. What is there, just in the way that we're living, that could have some impact? A statistic that I heard that's interesting is that here in North America, one thing we need to look at is our consumption. At the level of consumption, of the average North American takes 25 acres of land to produce enough goods. For the average North American. Extrapolate that across 6 billion people. If everybody's to live at our level of consumption, we need five Earths. Five Earths. Okay. Now, I look at some of the consumption, and some of it is just truly stupid, And some of it's just in how we think that it's cheaper to dispose of something and buy a new one than to fix the old one. My old laptop computer, which would, an equivalent now would be about $600 to buy, the motherboard went, and it was a $400 repair for the motherboard. So what's the point? You buy a new computer, right? Now, those motherboards we know cost, $20 to produce. But it's just within our system, we want to make the extra money. And so it's, so there's more money to be made in selling a new one than fixing an old one. And I don't know how to overcome that yet, but it's got my wrapped my head around it. Like being part in a company with a repair department, is there something that those of us who have companies that repair things can change the way we think about how much we have to make on a repair? You need to cover your costs. You need to make a profit. But how much profit do you have to make? Or can you change your thinking of, is there a way that's economical that we can repair old goods rather than have to replace them with new goods? I mean, this is this is just a way that I've been thinking, for the company I work for. Is there ways we can rethink this thing that we'd rather not repair? We'd rather sell a new one and make the repair economical. If my old computer could have been repaired for $200, I would have done it. But for $400, and then to be told, and something else will probably go soon too, and it might not work, I wasn't going to make the investment. So I bought a new one. And this is how it is throughout our culture. My transmission mechanic is shutting down his business. He says, the way the culture is right now, somebody comes in here, they need a new transmission. How much is it? $1,500 to $2,000. He says, next week I see him driving a new car. And he says, why are you doing that? He says, well, I didn't have the $1,800, but I could afford a $300 a month lease for a new vehicle. Okay? There's something in our system. And do we get caught up in that kind of thinking? We do. This goes back a number of years ago, but I had this fellow in at our shop, and he looked at this toolbox. It was $1,000. And he says, will you finance? I said, no, I'm sorry, we're not set to finance. So he comes out a couple weeks later, so you're still interested? He says, no, I bought a Snap-on. How much you pay for the Snap-on? $2,500. $2,500? He says, yeah, that's 2.5 times what this one is. He says, yeah, but I can pay for it, $200 a week. Something within our culture needs to change, that type of thinking that caused it to consume way beyond it. It's not just a matter of consuming less, like maybe I should eat less, or maybe I shouldn't have a car, or maybe I shouldn't have two cars, or it's got to get creative. It's got to get beyond that. Just how do I not buy so much stuff, to how can I more efficiently use and consume the goods and services that we have, so that there doesn't have to be such massive input to contribute to our lifestyle. And you know what? This isn't something that we go home, that we're to go home and just feel guilty about it, that we're just these evil, rotten, filthy, rich North Americans, and we're just really screwed up. Okay? Because that doesn't solve anything. That solves absolutely nothing. Okay? All that does is make us feel guilty. And what do we do when we feel guilty? We go shopping. Okay? That doesn't solve the problem. The problem is going to be solved by us as believers coming before God and saying, how do we turn the ship around? What can we do in our small part? It's not going to be a big political thing. The governments, I don't think, are going to figure this out, because look at the talk in the States. We've got a lower interest rate to get people spending more money to stimulate the economy. Okay? How do we get this going? How do we fix the economy? Get people to spend more, to consume more. So that is systemic injustice, because the more we consume, the more we're taking from those who have nothing. It's not a direct line, but we need to start there. It's not, and it's got to be smart in how it's done, because some people say, well, then let's boycott China or boycott South Africa. So what happens when you do that? Those who are the ones that are making a dollar a day go down to zero a day, because nobody's buying their product. It's not. Just a boycott's not going to fix the problem. It's going to be creative solutions, Opportunities International, going on microfinancing. I love, I'm going to do an advertisement here, 10,000 Villages. How many of you have visited that place on McAllister? Ruth has? You have? Okay. 10,000 Villages is a store. It's in the old post office. If you haven't been in there, if you buy gifts for Christmas and stuff, do your shopping in there, because this is what they do. They go into third world countries and look for third world artisans who are making gorgeous stuff, And they buy their products from them for 10% higher than the local market going rate. There's no sense giving somebody who's in a community where everybody's making a dollar a day, giving them $50 a day. Because that just creates a stupid inflation. Everything gets really messed up. You got to take it a step at a time. So now a lot of these communities are making better than a dollar a day, too. But they'll pay them about 10% more than the local market. So these artisans are doing better. They're just trying to sell locally. And if they can even sell locally. So now they have a market to sell this stuff. The stuff is then brought to North America to be marketed. And there's gorgeous giftware in there. And the money that goes beyond the money that goes to the manufacturer and what it takes to keep the store open. The store is mostly run by volunteers, by the way. Esther works in there a day a week or an afternoon a week. If any of you want to volunteer in something that's really cool, go check into it. Goes back. It's run by the MCC, Mennonite Central Committee. Goes back into working in the villages and upgrading water supplies and so on and so forth. So there's an organization that's out of the box, okay? There's money over here. There's people producing stuff over there. Bring the stuff over here. Help the artisans make a living. Take the profits. Put it back into the artisans' community. There's thinking out the box. The solution is not everybody being equal, everybody having the same. Because just God has given us different gifts. Some of us have a real knack for making money. Some of us don't. You know, there are people. How is it that you see these guys, they go bankrupt and a year later, they're back in the millions of dollars again, okay? If you think everything should be equal, interestingly enough, on a worldwide scale, these are people who are seriously concerned about social issues. Wrap your head around this one. What do you think the percentage should be, the difference percentage between the lowest paid worker in the chain, like somebody making Nike runners, and the president of the company? For an equitable company, this is from people who are thinking equitably, what would an equitable ratio be? If that person there is making $1 a day, how much should the president, the CEO, the top paid person in the company be making if the lowest paid worker is making a dollar? Anybody want to take a guess? Pardon? Well, that's what it is now, yes. It's actually 100-1, believe it or not. I mean, that sounds, in a sense, it sounds excessive. But that says if a CEO over here, the CEO is making $1 million, his lowest paid worker should be making $10,000. And even though it sounds like a huge spread, believe it or not, if the spread is held to that, it really does distribute the wealth so that nobody has to live on nothing. The problem is now is that person making a dollar a day is making stuff for a company whose CEO is making $100 million a year. And it's into the tens of thousands to one. And a wealth distribution of 100 to 1, they say you're never going to get it equal, but that gets the poorest of the poor. It gets them into gets them into something equitable. Capitalism goes way beyond the 100 to 1. Within North America, now that's globalized talk, okay? Here within North America, they say an equitable company is about 10 to 1. Okay, so if your lowest, if your CEO is making $1 million a year, your lower paid worker should be making $100,000. If your CEO is making, you know, or let's say $10 an hour is $20,000 a year. So if you're making $10 an hour, your CEO, the most he should be making for there to be any equitable relationship would be $200,000 a year. Okay, so you see doctors and lawyers make that. So those numbers. They work different locally than they do globally. But you know, as we're thinking down that line, it'd be interesting. What if the president of Nike decided on that? Okay, I'm going to make sure that my income is not more than 100 times the worker in Thailand sewing these things up. And so then all the CEOs of the huge salaries begin to come down. Still, I mean, you could. So the guy right now is making, I don't know, $20 million a year. So now he's down to, let's say, $1 million a year. I could live quite comfortably on $1 million a year. Thank you very much. Okay, and all of a sudden, these guys over there are making $10,000 a year. Okay, in China right now, a salary of $10,000 a year is actually quite good money. A well-paid engineer in China is making about $700 a month, which is about $8,000 change a year. Okay, so some because your world, your currencies are different. It gets a little screwy. But the more you look into this, the more you realize, okay, maybe some of this is doable. And ask God, okay, what can my part be? What can my part be of dealing with areas of systemic injustice? I've used this example before, Ruth, right here in our midst. Systemic injustice, the whole abortion thing. You know, girls without a choice. The system is such they've got to make a living. You know, the husbands don't. There's not necessarily a husband to hang around anymore. You've probably heard every story out there. It's why a person should get an abortion, right? And sometimes the system is such that it's hopeless. There's no other option. If they don't have an abortion, they're done, right? So there's an organization that's dealing with systemic injustice and providing alternatives for these women and counseling through, giving them other ideas, creativity. You know, that is what the kingdom of God is about, is getting outside of these boxes and systems. Or this is part of what the kingdom of God is about. This is the good news for the poor. It's not always just let me give you money. It's not always the rich just giving money to the poor. It's looking, what is the system that makes it so easy for the rich to get richer and the poor to get poorer? And what part can I play in that to begin breaking some corner of that system down? And that's where we need to stop and ask Jesus, what step, what parts can we play in that? What part can I play in it? What part can we as a church play in it? You know, because we don't have a building, we weren't functionally able to have a big part, to really have a part in what the local churches did in providing a shelter to the homeless in the winter. But there, the Rob Thiessen that was leading that up, there was a brilliant idea. They distributed the workload around. No one church took it all on. Volunteers from all the churches. It wasn't a huge effort on anybody's part other than getting the thing initially off the ground. Sometimes getting these things initially off the ground are a huge effort. You know, the whole NIMBY thing, which, you know, just kind of once came and gone, it's, you know, that's all dropped now. It's become a non-issue. A little bit of creativity made a difference in a lot of people's lives. Let's pray. Father, would you help us to continue to wrap our head around these things and to know the part that we can play. Father, would you protect us from guilt and fill us instead with hope, and to ask the question, what can we do with the rest of our lives that moves towards making a difference? Father, would you give us vision for this? Would you bring it up in our conversations amongst each other and when we're out and about, that we would be asking, what are the things we can do that can undo the suicide systems that are in place that harm so many? Father, would you send these thoughts home with us, that we wouldn't walk out of here and then just carry on, but that we would wrestle with this, that the conversations would continue. I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.